you know, Toby was a special person. Like, he was kind of like a savant. Like, I felt like I was talking to an outlier founder, and it's very difficult to explain. I feel one of the real, you know, privileges and benefits in my job is once you start finding some of these outlier finders, like the way they speak, the way they make decisions, the way they do things does not fit status quo. It's like borderline crazy, borderline insane. They do things that make you scratch your head, but somehow it works.
Welcome to the Product Market Fit Show, brought to you by Mistral, a seed stage firm based in Canada. I'm Pablo. I'm a founder turned VC. My goal is to help early stage founders like you find product market fit. I'm so excited for this episode today because we have an amazing guest who has joined us. Aydin Sencut is the founder and managing director of Felicis, which is one of the best seed stage and early stage funds in the world. They've invested in companies like Canva, Notion, and of course, in Shopify, which they invested in at the Series A when Shopify was just a $25 million company. And by the way, I was just looking this up before recording. Shopify today is a $100 billion company. So if you'd bought Shopify stock when they went public in 2015, we're talking about 8.5 years ago, let's say you put $20,000 in Shopify stock at IPO, which you could have done, you would have gotten a 50x return. That $20,000 would be $1 million today. So Shopify has fared quite well, not just for the VCs, but also for the retail investors that have believed in this company from the early days. And you know, one of the things that I think is just so interesting about Shopify's story is that right, in the world of these $10 billion, $100 billion, trillion-dollar companies, we're all so obsessed with exceptional growth. And exceptional growth in this context is like 10x growth. We want things to grow so fast. And Shopify, even though it became a $100 billion company today, never had that kind of growth. Shopify is not a story of 10x growth. Shopify is a story of 2x growth for 10 plus years. That's what they've done. In fact, if you look at Shopify's path from zero to $100 million in revenue, $100 million ARR, their average growth rate was 110%. In the world of venture, 110% oftentimes doesn't even put you in the top quartile. And this became one of the best companies of our time. And so again, I think this just hammers home the point that the most important thing is not how fast you grow, but for how long you grow. It's all about consistency. And that's really the story of Shopify. And so Aydin will be joining us later to tell us a bit about how he found out about Shopify, what it is that he saw in Toby and the Shopify team back then that made him so sure that this was a bet worth taking. And of course, it all starts off with Toby, who's the founder and CEO. You know, Toby, he's a developer at heart, been a coder since he could write. I mean, he's been coding since he was 6 years old. He's born in Germany in 1981. And, you know, fast forwarding through the early life, because that's not really what this pod is about. He moves to Ottawa in 2002. And at this point, he's about 20 years old, not a founder, not an entrepreneur, really, in terms of what he's spending his time on. I mean, he is a coder. And so he's working as a software programmer, in fact, at like an accounting company. Nothing necessarily that exciting is happening at this point in his life. Obviously, Toby's, you know, super, super smart person, but you would not, and I don't think anyone would have been able to point him out at this point in his life and figure out that he was going to become a billionaire and one of the most respected founders in the world and certainly number one in Canada. And so Toby's, you know, working at this company as a developer, and all of a sudden the company goes bankrupt. And so Toby is out of a job, and his first kind of move, and this is already interesting, like he doesn't kind of think to himself, okay, you know what? I'm out of a job. Now's the perfect time to start a startup. He's just like, okay, cool. Let's go find another job. This is where his mindset was at the time. And he starts actually looking for different jobs he can take on, different companies he can join as a developer. And he runs into the first obstacle, which is basically that, like, for different immigration related issues, his papers are just not in the right order. And so it's actually hard for him to get another normal job. This is when, like, you can see kind of serendipity playing in this context of him trying to figure out what he wants to do next. He gets introduced to one of the other players that's very important in the founding of Shopify. This guy, Scott Lake. And Scott Lake is like the yin to Toby's yang. If Toby is a product type, tech type, Scott Lake is the business half. And they start talking about, you know, different things they could do. They start exploring kind of potential business ideas. It was a bit of a perfect match between the two of them. But to be clear, neither of them have an actual startup idea. So they kind of start to manufacture it. They start to think about, okay, well, you know, if you're the business half and I'm the technical half, okay, that's cool. You know, what could we build? And at that point, both of them were very into snowboarding. And so they decide, well, what if we launched a snowboarding company? Like, what if we sell snowboards? But what if we, you know, do it a bit differently? Like, we don't sell the standard snowboards. We sell kind of different, more unique snowboards. And we just do it, you know, in a bit of a different way. And that's the kind of seed that starts them off this entrepreneurial path. And, you know, they say, like, constraints set you free, or there's power in constraints. It's very clear here, because the first constraint he hits, I mean, the first constraint is he's out of a job, which even puts him down this path in the first place. The second one, they don't have a lot of money. And so, like, their first idea is actually like, okay, we're going to start a store, but we need a brick and mortar location. Like, this is 2004, by the way. This is not today's world. This is 20 years ago. And the problem is they each only have like $20,000 to put into it. And it's just not really enough to get a store launched. And so they start looking at, okay, well, what if we did this online? What about e-commerce? That kind of e-commerce idea starts to make more and more sense to them. Okay, you know what? Let's do that. Like, let's start an online store. We'll sell snowboards online. And so, okay, cool. Like, Toby's in charge of product. He's in charge of tech. So he starts looking around to see, well, how are they going to build this store? Which platforms can they use? To be clear, like, it's not like there was nothing back then. There were options that you could use. There was Yahoo stores. There was eBay stores. There was OS Commerce. There were others, and you know, Toby kind of played around with a bunch of them, but none of them really let him do what he wanted to do. Yahoo stores was like too hard to customize. eBay stores, I mean, was really suited for auctions. OS Commerce was just too old and just too rigid. And so none of them were really like the platform for selling online. Actually, if you think about that, Yahoo stores, first and foremost, is like a search engine. eBay, first and foremost, is an auctions marketplace. They were both doing stores, but neither of them had the vision to become platform for commerce. You can start getting a sense of the opportunity. I'm foreshadowing here. Toby didn't see it like that at that time, but you can understand how there was kind of a gap in the market. And so Toby's faced with a bit of a problem, because they actually have a pretty clear idea of the sort of store that they want to build, of the sort of experience that they want to build online. And here's exactly how kind of Toby saw the choice, as he explained on the podcast called How I Build This.
I was like, there's only two ways forward. Like, I compromise my idea and do something that's very undifferentiated except for snowboards, or I'm going to fall back on my programming skills and I would build something that hopefully would be able to power this business.
And that's the choice that he faced, to like easy road, just work with what's out there and just kind of find a way to sell snowboards online, or maybe more exciting path, do what you imagined and put in the work. And in a sense, like, because he took that second path, this is like a Matrix, you know, red pill versus blue pill situation. And so clearly Toby takes the red pill. I think in a sense, that's what makes him a founder. That's what makes him special. I asked Aiden, the founder of Felices, who invested in Shopify back in 2010, what he thought of Toby when he first met him.
You know, Toby was a special person. Like, he was kind of like a savant. Like, I felt like I was talking to an outlier founder, and it's very difficult to explain. I feel one of the real, you know, privileges and benefits in my job is, once you start finding some of these outlier finders, like, the way they speak, the way they make decisions, the way they do things does not fit status quo. It's like borderline crazy, borderline insane. They do things that make you scratch your head, but somehow it works.
And one of the things that make Toby very different, I think one of the things that gave him an edge, is that he went really deep on problems that he was interested in. He had this innate curiosity. He let that curiosity take him wherever it took him. It's actually through this that he ends up landing earlier. This is not kind of down the snowboard store path. This is before. He lands on this language called Ruby on Rails. And he starts working with this language, Ruby on Rails, for the simple reason that he's interested in it. And he actually gets very, very deep. As far as like the founding of Ruby on Rails and the early development, he played a really big role in that. This is where things start to come together. His interest in snowboards, in entrepreneurship, and in Ruby on Rails come together, because he then realizes, wait a second, this language, Ruby on Rails, is perfect to build a platform that can power this snowboard store that I want to build. And I won't get into the like technical reasons, but bottom line, like Ruby on Rails, it just makes it easier and faster to build. It's just more scalable right at the outset. There's aspects about like database management that just make it really perfectly suited for what Toby wanted to build. But the bottom line is that Toby decides to go all in on this. And I, you know, just on a quick tangent here, Toby didn't start with Ruby on Rails and then say, oh, this is a really cool tool, really cool new technology, which he understood well. What can I build with it? Toby started with a problem, which was, I really want to sell snowboards online, but I can't find a way to build a store. And then kind of backed into, oh, you know what? Ruby on Rails will be a really good solution for that. Fundamentally, a technology is really just a tool. Until you have a problem, it's really hard to start from a tool and figure out what you could use that for. And that's exactly what we see here. And so Toby, well, he gets to work. When Toby wants to get something done, he gets something done. He spends 2.5 months, 16-hour days building this e-commerce store for snowboards. He's literally, by the way, like he's not thinking about building a platform. Like he's literally scratching his own itch. We've spoken in other times about different ways you can start an idea. And I think here, there's kind of four different frameworks we've spoken about. The one that's clearly at play here is scratch your own itch. So Toby has an actual problem and he just goes out to solve it. And to do it, he has to go all in. 16-hour days, 2.5 months. I mean, that's what it takes to start. That's, he has to go from zero to one, from none to something. I mean, if you just think about the force it takes to like get an airplane off the ground versus just to keep it in the air, that's the difference between zero to one and one to X. And when you're going zero to one, you need to push extremely hard because the second you take your foot off the pedal, it's a grinding halt. After 2.5 months, they launched this snowboard store online called Snow Devil. And it, you know, does pretty well. Like they're definitely selling snowboards. They're making money. They're not millionaires by any point, but things are working out. But then what happens, it starts to kind of change the course of history, let's say, is that when spring comes, it's a bit, you know, it's off season. People are not like thinking about snowboarding at that time. They've got to figure out kind of how to adjust to that. At the same time as they're kind of having these discussions about, okay, what are we going to do now that that we're no longer like in season? Toby starts to get these questions from people who have seen his online store. And they're asking him like, Toby, how did you like, what platform are you using to build the store, right? The store looks awesome. It works so well. Like I wanted to build a store for whatever. What did you use? And Toby's like, well, actually I built it. And so as he's getting this kind of more and more, they kind of get to this crossroads where they're like, look, there seems to be a lot of interest in the actual tech, like in the actual platform, maybe more so than in the snowboards. And by the way, the snowboards, that's a tough business. It can't really scale. And so Scott and Toby kind of have this discussion about, well, you know what? Maybe the game isn't Snow Devil. Maybe the game, the real opportunity here is this e-commerce platform. And I think just as important as what he did do is what he didn't do. Neither he nor Scott kind of started strategizing from here, right? They didn't build a full roadmap. They didn't build a deck. They didn't try to predict the future and start thinking backwards from, okay, if we want to be a $1 billion company, here's what we have to do. Literally, they're just taking one foot in front of the other. They're in pre-product market fit mode. And so all those like grand visions just don't matter all that much. What really matters is creating and delivering real value. Understanding the opportunity, the market size, the TAM, that comes way later.
Look, I think this is the biggest mistake, is basically try to estimate correctly what the market size is. You just need to know that if it works, it's going to be big enough. I will tell you funny stories also, like when I was at Google, I'm like, oh God, please let this be a $1 billion company. Everybody thinks I'm crazy. And, you know, Google became like a $1 trillion company. So I was off by three zeros, three orders of magnitude. I think the most important thing that people don't realize is that when we look at market size, we're looking at the market size with the existing product. I'm maybe older. I remember the days of like 9-12 key telephones. Until Apple came up with iPhone that had no keys and had App Store, like people thought telecom market is X. And Apple took it like 100 times, maybe 1,000 times larger. So what ends up happening is we look at existing market and we're like, well, because of these incumbents, you know, like this is as big as the market gets. But what it does not take into consideration is, what if all of a sudden you had something 10x better, 10x cheaper? And this is really important in terms of product market fit.
And that's exactly what ended up happening here. Like Shopify just made it so much easier to start an e-commerce store of your dreams. What you want to build, you can more or less build with Shopify. And it's at a click of a button, you can be selling globally. So he made it so much easier. He drastically lowered the constraints to get selling online. And by doing that, you know, grew the market. That's actually what happened. That's the story of Shopify. Millions of merchants now. We're obviously kind of getting a bit ahead of ourselves. So backing up, now we're in 2005. All Toby's really doing at this point is a bit cliche, but it's real. I mean, he's literally just listening to customers who are telling him this platform that he's built could solve their problems. And they're kind of pulling it out of his hand. And he's just letting that market demand pull him into the right direction. And now the nice thing is that because he started off by scratching his own itch, that was the framework he effectively used to start this idea. The upside of scratching your own itch is that Toby was just so intimately aware of the pain point. He deeply understood the pain point because it was his own pain point. Toby has a quote. He said, "I meet Shopify customers and I often ask them like, hey, where were you when you got that first order?" And everyone can remember it. That feeling of actually generating orders, you don't get that unless you went through it. And when you go through it and you understand the pain point so deeply, you obviously end up building better products. I'm pretty sure that Toby actually, even to this day, or at least for a long time after going public, was still running his own e-commerce stores just to like use his own platform and stay really close to his customers. Staying so close to his customers is what ultimately made the product so much better than everything else. So that was one thing that, you know, Toby was exceptional at. The other thing that Toby is excellent at is positioning. And I don't mean positioning like in the sense of, you know, market positioning. I mean it at a broader level. Just to back up for a second, there's this concept that the most successful people are excellent decision makers. And that's not untrue, but it misses the point. The most exceptional, kind of most achieving outliers, what they're actually doing is not so much making the best decisions, but positioning themselves so that their choices of available decisions are all great. Because you might be the best decision maker. If your back's against the wall and your set of available choices are go from bad to worse, even the best decision maker can't do much about that. And so the real game here is to put yourself in places where you basically can't lose. And Toby was so good at that. He, in a way, followed Paul Graham's advice before Paul Graham even gave this advice. Paul Graham, who's the founder of YC, says, "You should learn a lot about things that matter, work on problems that interest you with people you like and respect." And the bottom line is that if you're doing that, you're just increasing the odds that good things are going to happen. You are putting yourself in a better and better position. And clearly, this is exactly what Toby was doing. He spent so much time on Ruby on Rails. He spends time following the snowboard dream, and things just kind of start to come together. And it goes well beyond that. Like, here's another example. Toby doesn't decide to go out and just build this huge team. He stays very lean. So he brings on Dan Wynand, who is a good friend of his that Toby had coded with before. He knows him from Germany. So he brings him on. And it's literally the three of them. It's Scott Lake, it's Dan, and it's Toby. There's no overhead. There's no misalignment. There's no management. There's no waste on communication. There's no need to go and fundraise and raise big rounds so you can pay all these people. None of that. And that is great positioning for that stage of the company because your set of available choices are great. You only need a tiny little bit of money and you have the perfect team to just execute and deliver. He even decides to move in with his wife's parents. And by doing that, like, it might seem like a trivial choice, but if you think about it from a positioning perspective, what you can see is that what Toby's doing is aligning his life to his startup. He's not putting himself in a position where, oh, if I don't raise $5 million, I won't be able to pay myself a salary and I'll get kicked out because I won't be able to pay my mortgage. He doesn't take on all these burdens that could have made his set of available choices much worse. Instead, he lowers his cost of living as much as humanly possible and thereby just makes his set of available choices so much better. He didn't need to fundraise. He didn't even have like a personal runway. There wasn't this ticking clock. If we don't get this done by then, it's over. That is excellent positioning. So it might seem like a detail, but that really speaks to Toby's ability to constantly put himself in the best position possible.
One of the things that I've seen at Google is Larry and Sergey did some very unusual things. Like when we had less than 50 people, they took three people away and said, look, you're going to work on crazy research stuff that we might not even need for 3 years. But if we basically wait, we're never going to have that. So some people in the company were like dedicated, very expensive, very tough decision before we even had revenue. Say, look, work on crazy stuff. One day we're going to need it, but we cannot start building it you know, the day that we know that we're going to need it. And I had that kind of an epiphany that when I showed up in Ottawa, Toby told me that, hey, they had these amazing engineers and the team was, by the way, like less than 50 people or barely 50 people. And he said, I took two of my best engineers and we're building a real-time data warehouse. Like, even when the company was had a few millions of revenue and like it was very small, Toby was thinking like 15 chess moves ahead.
So now Dan and Toby, they're, you know, spending time just redeveloping the platform. Toby had built this e-commerce store to sell snowboards. He hadn't built this like e-commerce platform that others could build on top of. So he had to obviously rebuild a lot of it and add a bunch of functionality. And as they're doing this though, they don't go on like pure stealth mode, right? I think this is very interesting. They use the Snow Devil website as a kind of demo of the Shopify platform, and they use it to collect interest. They take 18 months to build out Shopify. In those 18 months, they collect 5,000 email addresses pre-launch. So that's excellent validation. He then, between this time, raises about $200,000 from friends and family. This is like 2005. I mean, inflation hasn't changed that much. So $200,000 is not a lot of money, but that's all the money because of the way that he had positioned. That was all the money that he truly needed kind of back then. And frankly, it helped because it set these constraints, made Shopify have to be lean. And that culture of leanness really penetrates your entire organization. There was actually, I just remember like listening to Jeff Bezos in the early days of Amazon being so worried about spending that he didn't even, like, he was packing on the floor with knee pads because he hadn't even thought about like buying a table. One of his employees says, hey, you should maybe buy a table, like then you can stand up. And he does it because he sees ROI. But my point is that he's kind of ingraining, and Toby's ingraining, this idea of staying lean, of being resourceful, of not overspending. And maybe it's by necessity. Like, I don't know that he was thinking about all this, but the result of raising small rounds, of having small teams, is that people think that every dollar matters. And that's obviously a great attribute to have in a company. Now, 2006 comes around and they finally build like the first MVP. So they launch this with like a blast email, right? They have 5,000 emails that they've collected. And his MVP, by the way, this minimum viable product, was like actually pretty sizable. He had like a customizable store template, a shopping cart, order tracking, inventory. You had like a plug and play payment processing. There's a lot of features in there. And that was like, if you think about it, I mean, part of it is if you're, you have to think about an MVP as the minimum way to get, you know, to deliver that value. And so if you want people to build a real store on your platform, well, the bar is pretty high. It's not the same thing as like disappearing images or, you know, a newsfeed. Like, you really need people to be able to operate entire businesses on your platform. I think the other thing though is that Toby is effectively like a product genius, and he has a very clear idea of how well the product needs to work. This is another thing that's interesting thing about it. He's selling to someone who's also going to be the user. So in some instances, you sell to like a VP of X, and the VP of X might make the buying decision, but he or she is not the one who uses the product. And in those cases, product might not matter that much. But in Shopify, the person who buys the platform, especially in the early days when these are SMBs, is going to be the person who also builds the store. So the product really mattered. Having a 10x product is extremely important to get demand.
You're not going to get a great company that basically takes something that is existing and makes it 5% different or 10% better. And it's another thing that I learned from Google is that if you're going to do something and it's going to be meaningful, like, it needs to be an order of magnitude better, faster, cheaper. You know, marginal improvements is not going to create an amazing product and an amazing company. And in the biggest learning from that is not that, of course, when you hear it, it sounds obvious, is that the non-obvious aspect of it is that the only way you can make it happen is by doing something that is very unconventional, right? 10%, 20%, you can like push through the margins with like a marginal improvement. But to be able to get to like a 10x better, 10x faster, or 10x cheaper, you have to completely change the way you think. Like, you have to redo things in a way that it needs to be almost reimagined. And only that level of innovation is going to result in a great product, in a, you know, truly enduring great company.
And so when they launch, they make the platform free for the first year with like a pretty high 3.75% take rate. That was like the original business model. and it made sense just to like get people in there, but obviously had a bit of a kind of moral hazard. I mean, who signs up to something that's free but takes a big percentage of your sales? Those are, generally speaking, businesses who are kind of high risk, right? Like they're just not sure if it's going to work. So they don't like the idea of paying up front, but they don't mind the idea of you taking a big cut if it works. And so that isn't, let's say, the perfect alignment between Shopify and its customers. So they change that and they add a kind of monthly SaaS of about $100 and they lower the take rate. And as they do that, the sorts of businesses that start launching on Shopify are better businesses, businesses that are actually going to, generally speaking, work out and grow sales. And about at this point, this is like 2007 or so, they raise $250,000 from an angel investor in Ottawa called John Phillips. And so at this point, you know, they have a bit more money, not a lot, but they have a bit more money. They have a few hundred accounts or so, and they're growing, but you know, it's a slow burn. Like I said, this is not a 10x story. This doesn't just take off. This is a slow burn. They're doing maybe a few hundred thousand dollars in revenue, plus some percentage of revenue that they're getting. Maybe in total, it's about $200,000 in revenue or so. This is not like, you know, we talk about how companies, you know, the top decile goes from zero to a million in a year. Well, Shopify was not top decile, but you know, it's a $100 billion company today because it's a story of consistent growth, right? Like the simple way of putting it is that if you 10x for 2 years, that's 100x. But if you 2x for 10 years, that's 1000x. So consistency is going to get you way further. And that's exactly what we see with Shopify. Now, again, getting ahead of ourselves, because at this point, 2007, Toby's ambition is still pretty limited. He said that his goal in those early days was for Shopify to be like a 20-person company that was super efficient.
My intention was to build a 20-people company. That's what I wanted to do.
That was his goal. Like he now has like 12,000 employees. They do $6.5 billion in revenue. He did not have this goal of a unicorn. He just wanted the small, efficient company. That's what he was thinking about back then. So at the end of the day, what you have is like somebody who understood product, understood technology, and consistently put themselves in the best position possible. He didn't necessarily predict the rise in e-commerce, but of course he benefited from it.
One of our big theses is if you're going to invest in a great company, the most important precursor is find a really important market. I always tell people that market is like gravity. You might dislike gravity, but gravity is not going away and you're always going to have to fight it. So if you don't start with a great market, it's very difficult to find a great company.
And then what he did is he just started to amplify that. So if you look at it, for example, like he worked on partnerships with agencies. So he would go to a kind of agency that would help you with your website and say, look, if you build on Shopify, we'll give you 20% of the lifetime revenue of that account. So that obviously started to bring in more customers. But there was like true product market fit here. There was a pull, and then there's the amplification of that pull. And one of the most important pieces when you think about amplifying something that's working is getting the right people on the bus. Frankly, one of the most important people that Toby brought on in the early days is Harley Finkelstein. Harley Finkelstein joined as chief legal officer and over time became chief operating officer and now is the president of Shopify. And so he's been with the company for 14 years. And Harley's role really was in evangelizing and telling the story of Shopify. And the way that Harley joined the company is actually quite interesting. Harley was one of the first users of Shopify. Harley had this t-shirt business, and at one point he basically meets Toby in Ottawa at a coffee shop and learns a bit about the platform, and decides to use the Shopify platform to make his t-shirt business fully virtual. And that's how he learns about it, and he kind of starts growing this business, and that's happening on the side. And John Phillips, who is like the main angel for Shopify, basically tells Toby, listen, Toby, like I think you've got a lot of people on your team that are just like you, and you should hire somebody different. And that's how Toby ends up bringing Harley into the equation, and they really become kind of that yin and yang, right? If Toby's more kind of the product introverted type, then Harley is more the extrovert storytelling type. And I think between Toby and Harley, the vision just kept getting bigger and bigger, and obviously they have this market pull that just keeps pulling them. So now we're like end of 2009, they're doing $2.5 million in revenue, up from $1 million the year before. And, you know, they're a cash flow positive company. They're doing well, but they start thinking about what they need to do to go even bigger. And so one of the things that Harley and Toby start to think about is maybe going out and raising some real money, not a few hundred thousand dollars, but a few million dollars. But before they do that, They want understanding if they can actually use that capital to drive real growth. They don't want to raise capital for the hype, for the PR. They don't want to do it just for the sake of it. The idea is to raise capital in order to grow faster. And so what they want to do first and foremost is to see, like, do they actually have growth levers? Like, do they have places where they can spend that capital and, you know, spend a dollar and get five out sort of thing? So what they do is they take $50,000 and they decide to run five different growth tests, right, at $10,000 each. And all of them work. All of them produce good results. They do like Google AdWords. They do an ebook. They do a bunch of different things, but they all produce a pretty clear ROI. And so like by 2009, it's clear that they have engines that they can lean into in order to grow faster. And another thing that actually is quite interesting that he did like back in 2010 is that they launched what became known as the Build a Business competition. And so the story is that Toby had met Tim Ferriss kind of a few years back, 2008, 2009. Tim Ferriss, even back then, was a big deal. He'd put out the book 4-Hour Workweek, which became a bestseller and so on. And he'd met Toby at a conference. Tim Ferriss had like heard about Shopify because obviously his whole thing is build these like simple online businesses that produce cash flow. And a lot of readers, a lot of people had told him that the best platform to use for e-commerce was Shopify. So he'd heard about Shopify. He meets Toby. They start talking. And effectively, Tim becomes kind of like an advisor to Shopify. And so in one of these kind of advisor calls, you know, Toby's telling him that he wants to do different things, you know, from a PR perspective, from a marketing perspective. And one of these ideas is to build a business competition. And so Toby's idea is, listen, like, let's run a competition where people build businesses on Shopify and the winner wins like a MacBook. And Tim's like, you know, this is a pretty good idea, but nobody cares about a MacBook. Like, you got to change that up. You got to get more aggressive. And so after some back and forth, Toby's like, okay, fine. What about a $10,000 prize? So the winner gets $10,000 cash. And Tim again pushes back and he's like, look, $10,000, you're just not thinking big enough. Add a zero to that. And so after some convincing, Toby comes around and says, okay, fine, let's do it. $100,000, build a business competition. At this point, Shopify hadn't raised the Series A. They'd only raised a few hundred thousand dollars in total. And so $100,000 back then was all of the money that they had in their balance sheet. That was all the cash that they had. And they put it all on the line to launch this build a business competition. And I think that's interesting because, you know, Toby's seen as this product tech, maybe introvert type, but he is clearly a bold risk taker. He's willing to take big risks when they make real sense. And in this case, it played out exceptionally well because what happened was by going with a really big prize of $100,000, it was actually the biggest kind of business competition ever at the time. And so he got so much free PR as a result because all the media outlets wanted to write about it, not specifically to like promote Shopify, but because $100,000 cash grant prize for the winner of a competition, that's a story in of itself. And so he created this kind of media story and got tons of PR, which led to the business competition really working because a lot of people signed up, used Shopify in order to build these businesses. He got 1,350 new businesses created on Shopify through this build a business competition. And that generated $3.5 million in gross sales. By the way, if you just do the quick math, at this point, they're charging about $100 a month. 1,350 new businesses, that's $135,000 in month one. So the payback period of this is negative because the way it worked was people have 6 months to build a business and the biggest business gets $100,000 on month six. So by that point, he'd had over 1,000 businesses using Shopify, presumably for like those 6 months. So that's like $600,000 in cash that he generated from free PR that he got because the headline was so powerful. And then he just used a little bit of that money that he got from those businesses ahead of time to give to the biggest business that that won that competition. So that was an exceptional PR marketing play that worked really well because it was simple and it resonated with his core audience. These are entrepreneurs. Most of the time, they want to earn. They want to make money. And so when you offer them up to $100,000, if they build the best business, that's an extremely attractive price. And so that really kind of clicked together and worked super well. Anyways, after trying out all these different tactics, it was clear they had these levers. And so Toby and Harley decide to go out and raise a Series A. And they're in Ottawa. That's where Shopify is based. Iden from Felices is on the other side of the continent in California. And Shopify was not really like a well-known entity. So I asked Iden how the round came together back in 2010.
That's a really funny story. I was actually tracking another company I was in Vegas. I believe the company was called 37 Signals. Things didn't go that well. They were very anti-VC. And I went back to my hotel room in defeat thinking, oh, great. Like, I missed this fantastic company. But again, it's kind of, I don't know. It's like the immigrant hustle. We had a like new fund. I'm like, we need to find big winners. One of the theses that we had was, hey, like, you know, commerce is taking off and there's going to be a big commerce platform. And then I found this blog post with Toby. And I'm like, what is this company, Shopify? I'm very intrigued. Sounded very interesting. And then I basically nonstop went trying to connect with Toby. I think it was maybe the seventh or eighth intro request that he replied to. Maybe he's like, okay, if I don't reply, this crazy Turkish guy from California is going to keep emailing me until he somehow gets through. But he did like come up with a test. He's like, look, it's January. It's one of the coldest days in Ottawa. Are you willing to get up on a plane, get on a plane and come here? And I did. And just met him and Harley. And it was one of the coolest conversations I ever had. And just based on that first meeting in Canada, in Ottawa, a couple months after, you know, me trying to break into the company, was an amazing conversation and became the foundation of us, you know, getting involved in their Series A. Look, some investors are in their ivory tower. Like, I remember this very vividly in the Shopify example. I'm not going to name, but I know Toby reached out to some VCs in Silicon Valley on Sand Hill Road, and they're like, had this imperious attitude of, Toby, what? Like, you're in Ottawa? Like, there's no way you can build a company here. You need to come to, you know, the Bay Area. And Toby's like, dude, I live in Ottawa. You know, I couldn't move to Bay Area. And I think this is one of these things that we always underestimate the incumbent. And they told Toby that it can't be done, like, let alone in a place like Ottawa. And why am I telling you this? And I think early on, when everybody's also telling the founders no, when you show up and like, wow, like, this investor took the effort to ask 8 different people to get an intro, is willing to get on a plane in like freezing cold. And by the way, like, I'm married to a Canadian. I had to do the same thing to meet her father, like, buy my 2 coats, show up when it's like negative 20 degrees out there. It's like, again, true love. And it was one of those things. Why am I telling you this? That founders are also like, you know what? This investor truly cares about my company. And then when you're also like, hey, I really believe in what you're doing, you know, we talk about product market fit. And sometimes I think for founders is like, is this investor the right fit for me? Do they really believe in me? And I think that's the misunderstood thing. A lot of people will say, you know what, I'm starting in VC. I'm going to copy a larger firm and I'm going to just like go after the obvious companies. And then when a hard company presents itself, they hit a wall. Immediate reaction is like, this is never going to work. I'm going to give up. And that's actually when the game really begins.
And so in 2010, they raise a $7 million Series A led by Bessemer with participation from Felicis. And you can actually go online and read Bessemer's memo and how they thought about this investment. They had a lot to say about Shopify, and obviously it's very positive. That's why they made the investment. They love the product. They love the team. One of the pieces that to me was really interesting was their exit analysis. And this is kind of this chart that VCs sometimes do to kind of understand what the probabilities are of the company growing to different levels and what the outcomes would be if they did. And so as I'm going through this, and so for example, they're saying there's a 30% probability that Shopify ends up exiting for $50 million. There's another 30% probability that Shopify ends up exiting for $100 million. The absolute peak that Bessemer thought of at the time of the investment was that Shopify might, in the best of cases, become a $400 million company. And they assigned a 3% probability to that outcome. Shopify today is over $100 billion. So they were off by about like 3 orders of magnitude. And this is not to say anything bad about Bessemer. This is to say the reality of market forecasting and just how impossible it is, even in the cases where you're right.
It feels like a joke, right? I mean, I think it was like a $25 million valuation, you know, $5 million investment. I don't even know how we made it to the mix. Like, I think we almost didn't, but we somehow stuck in there. But the main point is, even like when the company was small, when things were not obvious, Toby was thinking about crazy things. And I feel like in some ways, I'm very grateful and lucky and fortunate to have worked for other outlier technical founders like Larry Page at Google, where he also did a lot of things that was not obvious. In hindsight, brilliant. At the moment, not obvious. A little crazy. Outlier moves that nobody, like, it was not conventional. It was very unconventional. And it gave me the feel with, like, the approach to a huge market in an unconventional way and doing unconventional things. Somehow, like, in my mind, I'm like, look, these people are underestimated just because in Ottawa, everybody's telling them they can't do it. But somehow, like, in my gut, I felt like this was the team to back. I felt that Shopify decently had, like, a chance to become a billion-dollar company. I did not want to fall into the trap of, like, estimating the market size. Instead, like, we had a different philosophy, which is, like, look, commerce market, as long as there will be shops in the world, there is going to be a need for storefronts. It's just that we had physical storefronts. Now we need the online storefronts. Then you look at it, honestly, like, if we talk about Shopify or some of our other hits like Canva or Notion, it's like you take a very complex product and look, if the product is really complex, fewer people are going to use it and you're charging a high price, you're also limiting the market. But if it was much cheaper, much easier to use, there might be 10, 100,000 times more people using it. And so that was our thinking, that if you have an online store that is much better than every other alternative and, you know, it's subscription and not like this huge amount of money, all of a sudden, like, market could be different than what we expected. The question is, do we have the faith that this is the company to do it? And that's where, like, some of the outlier thinking, some of this, like, 10 chest move ahead strategy that Toby and Harley had, that's what strike me as, okay, if they're already thinking about stuff like this, I kind of have faith that they're going to figure it out.
What Bessemer and Felicis saw here was really just a very strong team with a very strong founder and exceptionally clear product market fit in a market that, you know, was not clear yet how big it could be, but that potentially could be big. What happened after this investment is the company just didn't stop doubling. They went from zero in 2006 to about 200,000 in 2007, about a million in 2008, 2.5 million in 2009, and then they just doubled and doubled and doubled until they hit $6.5 billion in revenue today. Obviously, today they're not doubling anymore, but they're still growing like 20% or so per year, which is pretty crazy at those numbers. Overall, big picture, they grew 1,200x in 13 years. And one of the reasons that they were able to double so consistently year after year is that they just kept innovating. They kept adding new products and just kept expanding.
I think if you looked at the distribution of the revenue by product underneath, it was choppy. And it was unpredictable. But then you see that it was genius that every time they added a new product and products over time, that resulted in a more predictable, more consistent, smoother growth curve. And that was another brilliance. Another thing that was very unique is that they could have taken a lot more from the market, charged a higher price, changed their pricing, but they opted for the long term, right? Like, they on purpose, like, charge a very low price for the product. Whenever they added a product, the way that they priced it was based on, you know, ROI for the customer, right? Like, they made things in a way that if your usage went up, the price went down, or like you got into a different tier, they could easily have done something else under VC pressure to maximize short-term gains. And why am I telling this is that it's all these hard decisions, right? Like, similar to, like, again, I know we're talking about Shopify, but not Apple, but there is a great analogy there. You know, like, I'm sure when they were launching iPhone, they're like, dude, what are you doing? Like, we have this thing called, you know, iPod. Like, why are we doing this iPhone? Like, we're going to kill this cash cow, but which ended up being like 100 times bigger. And it's not an easy decision when you're like, well, there is easy money here. We're going to like ignore it, but we're going to do something hard and it's going to take longer to make returns. But it's those kind of decisions that then sets it up to be that much bigger company.
The last thing I'll mention about Shopify, I think it's especially relevant today now that capital efficiency is like all the rage, is that this company was exceptionally lean. From the time that they started to the time they went public, they raised $100 million in total. And when they went public, they had $97 million on their balance sheet. So the net cash used in all that time was just $3 million. It was incredibly capital efficient. Toby and his team, despite being so capital efficient, kept raising every 12 to 18 months. They raised an A and then a B and then a Series C before going public. Toby wanted optionality, which is basically the result of great positioning. We've talked about positioning this whole time, but when you make the right moves ahead of time, you just end up in great positions. And when you do that, you have way more options. They could have not raised, and then they would have held on to a few more percentage points. But what if things didn't go perfectly right? And on the flip side, what if there was a big opportunity that they needed to lean into? So he didn't need the money, but the opportunity was so big that it made sense for him and the Shopify team to trade cash for a little more dilution. Toby wanted optionality, which is basically the result of great positioning. We've talked about positioning this whole time, but when you make the right moves ahead of time, you just end up in great positions. And when you do that, you have way more options. They could have not raised, right? And then they would have held on to a few more percentage points. But what if things didn't go perfectly right? And on the flip side, what if there was a big opportunity that they needed to lean into? So he didn't need the money, but the opportunity was so big that it made sense for him and the Shopify team to trade cash for a little more dilution. And ultimately, it all worked out. And it all worked out more than anything because the level of customer love, word of mouth, and of product market fit was just that strong. I just gave you content that you liked so much, you actually listened to the end. And guess what? You didn't pay a single dollar. Not only that, I didn't even put any ads in your face. So you just got a bunch of content for free. And now that I've delivered that value, I'm asking for something in return. Open your app, open Apple Podcasts, open Spotify, open whatever app you use to listen to this and hit that follow button. It's actually going to help you because it's going to help you make sure you don't miss out on the next episode, which you like so much that you listen to the whole thing.